Hello and welcome to the BS History Podcast. My name is BS Dreyer, and whether or not those initials are fitting, I'll let you judge. Now today, I'm going to talk a little bit about the history of quarantines. It seems very appropriate at the time of recording, in the midst of corona lockdowns across nations, across the globe. But the morbid fascination has always been there, really, with historians anyways, in terms of pandemics, epidemics, and the ways in which our ancestors have tried to fight disease. Of course, it's not just historians. A lot of people look to both fiction and history in order to better contextualize their lived experiences, and it is no wonder that right now both fiction and non-fiction about epidemics and pandemics are particularly popular. But today I just wanted to sort of dive on into quarantines specifically and their use throughout history. So when we look at the very earliest mention in human history of quarantines, we look at the Bodhyana and Gautama Sutras of ancient India, where they recommend a sort of quarantine protocol to protect newborns and relatives of a dead person. So this is about 800 BC, and already, at least in India, there is a certain knowledge about disease, and particularly disease that spreads among humans, and an acknowledgement of a contamination source, dead people, bodies, and a sort of acknowledgement of a particular subset of population that is vulnerable, and in this case, newborns. So pregnant women were advised to leave the village or their place of living for a while and sort of live in a secluded area, of course not without any support, that would sort of defeat the purpose, but just in order to make sure that they and their newborn in the first couple of weeks of life had the best chances of, you know, not getting anything, any disease that would seriously compromise their ability to survive, because of course at the time also childbirth for the woman as well as the baby was a much more dangerous prospect, and people acknowledged this and knew this. So that's just the earliest mention, it should be said, in terms of text. So it's probable that some sort of quarantining has been going on throughout human history for far longer than we will ever know. So that's a fascinating perspective on our current predicament. An early mention of isolation in terms of isolation because of disease is also in the biblical book of Leviticus, written in the 7th century BC or perhaps earlier, which describes the procedure for separating out infected people in order to prevent spread of disease under the Mosaic law. So this is Jewish religious law. If the shiny spot on the skin is white, but does not appear to be more than skin deep, and the hair in it has not turned white, the priest is to isolate the affected person for 7 days. On the 7th day, the priest is to examine him, and if he sees that the sore is unchanged and has not spread in the skin, he is to isolate him for another 7 days. So here, you kind of have the procedural manuscript for a particular disease, and you have a person, an expert, in this case the priest, who is supposed to be the caretaker of a patient and keep tabs on this person. So as a society, Mosaic laws were meant to really just to ensure survival across the board. And one of the much more famous ones is of course kosher, and all the restrictions about what food to eat and what food not to eat. And a certain number of historians believe that a lot of the reasons for it was the place, the time, and the climate, and the lack of hygiene standards, which resulted in a visible sort of effect if you ate those types of foods. And in the same way with certain diseases, they saw that certain procedures would be a good idea in order to ensure survival, not just of the person, but of the whole community. Now, even later, the Islamic world also has some interesting quarantining praxis. They actually have mandatory hospital quarantines of special groups of patients, including those with leprosy, and it started very early in Islamic history. The 6th Umayyad Caliph Al-Walid I built the first hospital in Damascus and issued an order to isolate those infected in Damascus with leprosy from other patients in the hospital. So not only do you have quarantining in a hospital where you keep all your sick people, but you have within the hospital a subsection for a known contagious disease that you definitely don't want to spread to neither the outside population, but also not within the hospital and make sick people sicker. So there's that whole understanding of disease is probably better than what we imagine. And of course, when I say Umayyad, you have to understand this is very early. This is a few hundred years after Islam even appears as a religion. So in the relative grand scheme of things, it's quite early on, probably earlier than a lot of people imagine, because a lot of people have a picture of how people dealt with health and sickness as a sort of more Anglo-centric or Europe-centric perspective, where we know the stories from the Middle Ages in Northern Europe, where everybody was throwing buckets of shit in the faces of each other, which is also kind of not right. I mean, not that they didn't do that, that didn't happen, but it wasn't like a crazy, just infested all the time type thing, because people did know a little bit more than we tend to give them credit for. Speaking of the Middle Ages and Europe, the word itself, quarantine, originates from quarantena, the Venetian language form, meaning 40 days. So this is due to a 40-day isolation of ships and people practiced as a measure of disease prevention within Venice and within Venice's territory, Venetian territory. So the background, of course, is that between 1348 and 1359, the Black Death wiped out somewhere between 25% and 30% of Europe's total population, and a significant percentage of Asia's population too, but it was a less severe number of cases because the plague originated in Asia and had had offshoots beforehand, so there was some immunity. At least that's the prevailing theory, because in Asia there were more people and they lived closer, so a sort of already built-in immunity might be the reason why it went relatively smoothly in Asia, as opposed to Europe, where it was a complete catastrophe in many ways. So the Black Death happens, and Europe is faced with what the trade that they are conducting towards the East brings back home. They don't know that that this is the case necessarily, but they do know that it spreads with ships. They've noticed this phenomenon, and Europeans are savvy to this aspect of disease spread. So first in Venetian territories, they isolate people for trentine, which is 30 days. And then in 1448, so this is 100 years after the advent of the Black Death, the Venetian Senate prolonged the waiting period to 40 days, thus giving birth to the term quarantine. And this 40-day quarantine proved to be an effective formula for handling outbreaks of the plague, because after the plague, the Black Death, first arrives in Europe, it comes back in subsequent waves of infection and disease, but with a much slower mortality rate, because there is some resistance in the population in Europe in general. And according to current estimates, the bubonic plague had a 37-day period from infection to death. So this means that the Venetian quarantine actually is exactly the right number of days, not exactly, but almost exactly the right number of days, and would have been, or was, very highly successful in determining the health of crews from potential trading and supply ships that were docking into ports in Venetian territory. So, as humanity's knowledge of diseases and their causes spread, the idea of quarantining gained much more widespread acceptance, even for people showing no symptoms. So in the Middle Ages, diseases like syphilis, where symptoms didn't show until long after the infected could give the disease to others, spread, well, practically unhindered. In fact, some evolutionary scientists believe that the risk of STDs, many of which can cause infertility, is part of why humans have a propensity for coupling in monogamous pairs. But I digress. So some diseases, such as syphilis, don't have the same level of symptoms showing as, for instance, the bubonic plague, which is a very obvious disease. And when symptoms show up late, or not at all, or are easily hidden, the effectiveness of quarantining obviously becomes an issue. So as previously described, the sort of trial and error approach is what made quarantining eventually effective against the plague in Venetian territories. They eventually hit the correct number of days that they needed to wait before they could be sure that nobody carried the disease with them into towns. But of course, this was only for these sort of visible diseases, and those diseases that were, you know, calamitous if they spread. You can say what you will about syphilis, it's a terrible disease, but it doesn't kill you immediately, and it doesn't kill everybody else around you unless you have sex with everybody else around you. So it's much more easily, in the Middle Ages at least, dismissed as sort of a sinner's disease, which I guess in terms of religious law it was or is, and people did not really concern themselves with certain subsets of diseases and disease prevention of those diseases, such as syphilis, because of societal ideas. So quarantining in Venice is relatively, and in Venetian territories, is relatively effective. We do know, of course, that these practices were a hassle for traders across Europe and indeed Asia, where many other towns and territories and countries practiced something similar to the Venetian quarantines. And they were paramount for the protection of the populace, because if you have an outbreak, you can't treat your population. The medical science is not up to that yet, so you pretty much have prevention as the only effective way of combating diseases. So quarantining practices are widespread in the Middle Ages, and although it was a hassle for traders, they do seem to have accepted that it was necessary. Of course, the pace of trade and travel in the Middle Ages was very much different from today, so adding a month to a trip that took several probably didn't hurt merchants terribly, because you already expected a very long sort of wait time before your investment eventually returns, if it does at all, and there are other dangers for traders and merchants traveling to and from places. So this sort of minor inconvenience of, you know, being quarantined for a month is worth it, also because you know then that you're allowed to trade as much as you want, and you know that you're not bringing disease back when you go back to your home or your next destination, go further on. So it must have seemed like a necessary evil, and the resistance to it, at least recorded resistance to quarantining, are few and far between, and they're mostly from, you know, subsets of populations where they were unfairly quarantined because of racist sentiments or religious persecutions, etc. And of course, in those cases, the actual quarantining was just sort of an excuse, and rarely had anything to do directly with disease, although they often did spring out of a fear of disease, these sort of racist quarantinings. Perhaps an interesting question is, why Venice? Why was Venice the place where quarantining practices were formalized and gave us its English name? Today, of course, the city is mostly known for canals and churches, but in the Middle Ages, Italy was a main hub for trade in Europe between, you know, really between Europe, Africa, and Asia, so all three known continents. And it, the country Italy was divided into sort of a patchwork of feuding principalities, city-states, kingdoms, and republics. And Venice was, through long periods, the strongest trading power in the Mediterranean. The strongest naval power in periods too, and the city-state had large parts of the Italian eastern coast and parts of modern-day Croatia and Cyprus and Crete under its control during different periods, and alongside its rival, the similarly republican city-state of Genoa, home of Christopher Columbus, on the other side of Italy, Venice controlled a massive portion of goods being imported into Europe. So it was only with the increasing hindrances to European trade to the east, the same problems that spurred on the Age of Exploration, that weakened eventually Venetian power and made it a much, you know, weaker state, and eventually let it be absorbed into a unified Italy much, much later. But in the Middle Ages, particularly the early Middle Ages, Venice really was it. You know, it was the place where Marco Polo traveled from, and it was sort of the European end post on the Silk Road. So it really had a lot going for it. It was huge in terms of territory and people, number of people living and working there, coupled with how many people were traveling into and from the city. It makes sense that Venice was the originators of quarantining practices as we sort of know them today, at least in that sort of formalized version that effectively hinders a disease. As we move up through history, and with the advent of the Age of Industrialization, with ever-increasing population growth and increased global trade and travel, quarantining practices were still widely used to curb the spread of diseases such as the different types of influenza and cholera. Of course, the 1918 outbreak of influenza, misnamed the Spanish flu, is one example where quarantining was vital in efforts to curb its spread, albeit admittedly not particularly effective considering the very staggeringly large number of people who died from the Spanish flu. The reason the Spanish flu is a misnomer is that it wasn't Spanish in origin, but because Spanish newspapers during the First World War were not under the same kind of wartime censorship that many other European countries imposed on their newspapers, the Spanish were the first to report on the disease in earnest, giving the outbreak its name. At the time, in 1918, diseases were still far from fully understood. And in fact, my own great-grandfather was mistakenly sent to an isolation ward for influenza patients, but luckily it was discovered that he actually had a gastrointestinal infection, and he was sent away again before he transferred that infection to the already weakened influenza patients. Would have been bad. But that example is also part of why quarantining has been heavily opposed to at times throughout its use, and particularly as we move into the industrialized age where people have much easier access to media, particularly telegrams and newspapers, it's easier somehow to drum up racist sentiments against certain subsets of population, and when you do that, then you have the backlash, of course, from that population or from people who support, you know, that particular subset of the population's right to live and work and do what they want in whatever respective country. There are multiple examples. Of course, pogroms against Jews in Russia were sometimes excused as sort of disease prevention measures. In the United States, you have a lot of people accusing Chinese and Asian immigrants in general of carrying disease, and a lot of terrible stuff as a result. And there are many more examples from, you know, sort of turn of the century, 1800s, 1900s, and of this kind of quarantines being used as a racist measure, and the backlash against quarantining as a result of quarantine practices being misused in this way. And of course, sometimes opposition to quarantines was not based on any societal big issues, but rather the fact that being sent into quarantine could potentially, at times at least, be pretty much a death sentence, because in quarantine, or at least if you were convinced you didn't have a disease and you were put into quarantine, you would get that disease. And sometimes quarantines were basically just holding cells for people with incurable diseases that, you know, you knew would eventually kill them. So that's stuff like pneumonia and things like that. At the time, if you got really sick with it, you just died, and you had a huge chance of transmitting that disease. So being sent there, if you weren't sick or convinced you weren't sick, would probably cause you at least some concern. Another interesting facet of quarantining practices during the 19th and 20th century is the sort of odd but very effective disease prevention practice of reverse quarantining, with villages and communities secluding themselves in order to avoid an outbreak of some kind of disease. As news of outbreaks could be gotten through newspapers and later telegraph and telegram much faster, this strategy was sometimes the easiest and most effective for many people. Sometimes these self-seclusion tactics operated under the assumption that doctors themselves poisoned or otherwise were somehow the cause of diseases such as cholera. In Romania, there are instances of villages convincing soldiers sent to open them up for inspection, open the villages up for inspection, convincing those soldiers that they were, you know, that the village people were right, and turning into sort of volunteer guards. And strangely, they were not completely wrong. As hygiene standards left much to be desired, doctors were at a far greater risk of exposure and could easily be vectors for the diseases that they were treating. So, deliberate poisoning was not really the cause of these diseases and their association with doctors, and that seems kind of silly in retrospective. But it wasn't necessarily a bad idea to be on the lookout for doctors when they could potentially carry disease that you're very much interested in not having spread in your small community or village. During the 20th century, there was another sort of really significant breakthrough in disease prevention. One of the first individuals identified as carrier of a deadly disease was Mary Mallon, better known as Typhoid Mary, who was quarantined twice, first for 3 years and after release again for nearly 24 years until her death, after she was identified as an asymptomatic or symptomless carrier of typhoid fever. So identifying groups more often than not based on existing prejudice as carriers of disease was nothing new, but with Typhoid Mary's case, not only was the world now privy to asymptomatic spread of disease, it was apparent how much damage just one person in the wrong place at the wrong time could cause. Typhoid Mary worked as a cook, and when there was first evidence of her spreading the disease, she kept working as a cook. So her quarantining is a sad story, but in fact postmortem abduction did reveal live typhoid bacteria in her system, so the measures were extreme but not baseless. And if somehow you would have been able to cure her, that would have been a good way to go about it. But of course her living in New York at that time and carrying that disease and continuing to carry that disease after her first quarantining, it does seem like it was somehow perhaps the most gentle way of dealing with the problem to send her back into quarantine. So that was a few historical examples and information about quarantining and, you know, other disease prevention methods that all have a long and intricate history. And we can safely say that although measures taken today are far from fun, they are far from the historical extremes in disease prevention. You can find me on Twitter at BSHistoryPod. That's at BSHistoryPod. And as always, I hope you feel like today has been slightly more history than BS. Until next time, thank you for listening.